I will try to be both straightforward and illuminating, so to speak. Well, okay, so I will talk about how water vapor masers illuminate shocks in hypersonic turbulence. I'm here in the physics department, and my collaborator on the more recent of this work is Tarja Liljeström. And so basically, the outline of the talk is, first I'll try to convince you that H2O masers are shocks, and I'll say that there are shocks in winds from protostars, and then I will describe how they trace hypersonic turbulence in those winds. Let's see, so, well, I remember once talking with someone who was working on cosmic strings, and they told me that this field was advancing rapidly. We understood the cosmic string network in the universe much better than we did a few years ago. And they asked what I was working on, and I said masers, and they said, could you remind me what a maser is? So I'll try and define a maser, or at least describe what it does. This is actually the, well, this is, so let me do that in a couple of view graphs. This is the energy level diagram for water, actually one species of water. It's the rotation level diagram at lower energies. So water's a triaxial ellipsoid and has a very complicated spectrum. Let's see. And it turns out that in this spectrum, there happen to be two levels, these two, which are extremely close together. The 616 level is actually very slightly above that. The difference in energy between the levels is corresponds to a photon frequency of 22 gigahertz. And so that's to be, so roughly in Kelvin, I suppose that would be something like 0.3 Kelvin or so. That's to be compared with these differences in energies between these states on the order of, say, 200 Kelvin for energy differences, and a height above the ground state of about 600 Kelvin. So these are very close together just by chance. So now on to masers. Essentially, maser action requires departure from thermal equilibrium. In thermal equilibrium, the ratio of atoms in this upper state of that transition divided by the number of atoms in the lower state would be given by the Boltzmann factor, which involves the difference in energy between those states. And so this is the usual Boltzmann factor, and you can see that for any temperature between zero and infinity, the number of atoms in the upper state is going to be less than that in the lower state if this equality held. In maser, when maser action occurs, there's actually more atoms or more molecules in the upper state. And so basically what happens is that when a photon comes in, essentially all of the atoms in the upper state dump their energies to generate identical photons, which combine with that one and propagate onward and can in fact stimulate further emission of photons down the line if this population inversion continues over some region of space. And essentially for this particular water line at a frequency of 22 gigahertz, essentially all the, all of the emission that we see certainly from astrophysical sources is stimulated emission because the natural lifetime of the state is about 30 years. So essentially we see no spontaneous emission, it's all stimulated. So we need some pumping mechanism that creates a departure from thermal equilibrium. And for water, it turns out that pumping mechanism essentially has to be collisions. There's no way, go ahead.
Should the number in the upper state actually be greater than the lower, or just more enhanced than the Boltzmann?
It has to be actually greater, so it has to be more. There is a slight delicacy involving the degeneracy of the states, but it, if the lower state has greater degeneracy, then you can get around it. But essentially, it has to be greater. It has to be greater, and there's the question of how much greater does it have to be, and at least for these masers, that difference doesn't have to be very large. It can be a tiny fraction of a percent. Let's see. Okay, so and that pumping mechanism for water has to be collisions. And the problem essentially is photon number. The numbers of photons that come from these masers, which amplify some stray input photon, perhaps from the cosmic microwave background, the number of photons that come out is extremely large. I won't quote a number. We'll see some examples later. And for every, if you have a radiative pump that somehow radiation lifts atoms or molecules preferentially to this state rather than that one, it's possible to imagine that, but every input photon has to have this energy. So that would be corresponding to a 100 or 200 Kelvin, whereas the photon that you get out is degraded in energy in comparison to that by a factor of 1,000. So essentially it's an energy problem, and there simply isn't enough radiation around to provide that.
What do you mean by degraded?
So the input photon has a I hate inverse centimeters, but essentially these transitions, these energies are those of far infrared photons. So for every pump photon that you put in, one molecule goes to this upper state of the transition and then produces at best one maser photon out. So you've taken a far infrared photon and made it into a radio maser photon. And even when, so the sort of like I would be happy to sell you pennies for a $100 bill. Each penny, and you can imagine that if you're receiving a lot of pennies, then you're probably not taking up on that deal. Yeah, exactly. So they have to be collisions, and those collision mechanisms are most easily realized in shocks. That was first understood by Strelnitsky. There's an excellent model of mazing in a J-shock by Elisser, Hollenbach, and McKee, and more recently Kaufman and Neufeld showed that you can also have maser action behind a C-shock. I asked Kaufman what the physics behind this was, and he said, well, there's this very complicated reaction network and so forth. But in the high-velocity shocks, essentially what happens is that the molecules are dissociated when they pass through the shock. The dust grains aren't destroyed. And then after the shock, molecules reform on the grains, heat the grains up, and thermal electrons from the grains provide the collisions with water molecules that produce this population inversion. And there's this nice post-shock plateau. It's about...
But the molecules, when they are excited, they are still
on the grains? No. I think the picture is that... The grains go through the shock. Gradually, things begin to settle down. The molecules reform, and they form on the grains and then move out into the interstellar medium. But this process goes on for quite a ways. The distance behind the shock is about an astronomical unit or so over which this occurs. And so during that time, the grains become quite hot, or I don't know how hot, and emit thermal electrons, which then go out and excite the water molecules that have previously been formed. So there's a... Does it make sense?
But it's quite an ensemble of very sophisticated reactions that you are describing.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, the
are the grains heated by photons from cooling lines?
Simply from the latent heat of essentially a formation of H2. So I'm not sure what the binding energy of H2 is. It's AU.
I see the molecules that settle on the grains. I mean, the atoms that settle on the grains form the molecules, and the molecule leaves
leaves the grain hot. Just so, exactly.
If and you want, just
so it is. It's sort of sounds like a Rube Goldberg way, but. I suppose this was actually kind of a discovery that Hollenbach and so forth made, that these conditions existed behind the shocks, and then what a great place to have water masers. I suppose actually.
Does it not depend on the detail of the shock? Can this depend on the detail of the shock?
Well,
velocity. Yeah, velocity. I mean, there have different shocks, don't you?
Uh-huh.
There are boundaries above which you can't get water measures. You have to have more density. You have to have
okay. So how broad are these boundaries, roughly?
Well, let's see if I can answer that. I think...
that's not the key issue.
I think, well, one very important issue is that the temperature has to be around 300 Kelvin. And there are different ways of seeing that. The way that I view it is that if you have, if you look at this energy level diagram, well, clearly if you have a temperature of 100 Kelvin, then the number of molecules that will be candidates for promotion to this state is going to be very low. On the other hand, if you have a temperature of 2,000 Kelvin, then, one expects a very, that N upper is equal to N lower throughout here, and there aren't very many candidate processes that will enforce a population inversion. So you want a temperature that's sort of in here somewhere, where there's a gradient of populations across the zone of that transition. We also require relatively high densities. I don't have a simple explanation for that. I think this can actually range over about four orders of magnitude, from about 10 to the 8th to 10 to the 12th. 10 to the 10th is the number that people quote. And I think...
that's because the time scales for forming the molecules in the greens are very large. So you require...
Okay, yeah. I certainly buy that. Yeah, that sounds good. Pardon? $100 bill in return for a penny. Okay, it's also true that the line of sight has to have some velocity coherence. In other words, you can't have completely random velocities along the line of sight. Although it's possible that you could have a situation like this, where these two little clumps of population inverted gas have actually the same Doppler velocity if you're standing over here. The region of that population, the velocity coherent, Doppler velocity coherent population inversion is, I guess I'm not making sense here. In other words, in order to amplify a photon from a preceding water molecule, even if it's in this upper state, the water molecule has to be able to emit a photon with the same Doppler shift. So the differences in Doppler velocity along the line of sight have to be less than the Maser line width. So one requires, of course, that constraint is only enforced on the component of velocity toward the observer. And one can imagine rather complicated structures where that region of velocity coherence is not continuous. Okay. Collisionally de-excite the upper level and thus quench Maser action. I know you don't get much action above 10 to the 12th. But,
So it's not much above that.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that N could be as low as 10 to the 6th.
That's possible.
I remember EHM. I mean, there's also a cushioning factor. You have to have fairly high magnetic fields.
Oh, for 10 to the 6th? Okay, yes, I can buy that, yeah.
When you say the shock models require the that's what's the trigger of the Maser action?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, maybe 10 to the 6 is the pre-shock and 10 to the...
Oh, okay, I would
buy. Yeah, okay. So this is the post-shock density that you're requiring.
Okay, so most of these constraints on pumping come about from photon number, and actually you can get around them, at least in principle, by making the Masers very beamed. So in other words, this Maser clearly will amplify a photon much more if it's traveling in this direction than if it's traveling in this direction. So even in the linear approximation, one gets very intense beams of radiation in a very small solid angle in this if the maser is long and thin. If it's short and fat, then you get more isotropic emission. And the problem is that in this case, for the same picture of pumping, you're taking the pump collisions, photons, whatever, and diluting them over a much larger solid angle, so you get much lower photon rates and therefore much lower intensities if the beaming is not as strong. So there's a bit of a trade-off between beaming and pumping mechanism.
Is the difference between a laser and a maser that the maser is driven by or pumped by collisions and the laser driven by pumping?
Yeah, that's right.
Maser. So even a laser is driven by collision, is
it? It can be.
It could be pumped, but not any different.
The helium neon. Yeah.
High energy photons.
Okay. Well, now let me move over to talking about observations of H2O masers.
Do you have to have the emitting region has to have this filamentary structure?
Okay. There's. Not absolutely. It's. I can kind of talk a little bit about this if you'd like. It, essentially, for the maybe let me get it back to it a little later. But it's an interesting question. From the observer's point of view, the masers are very strong. They're very common. They have interesting spectra. They vary a lot, and so they're fun to observe. And so there are lots of telescopes, especially small telescopes around the world, where people spend a lot of time just observing masers, monitoring them, and they're quite spectacular. They have flux densities. The flux density in one maser feature, one spike in the spectrum, might range typically from less than a Jansky to at least a million Janskys, which would make it at the particular little frequency that it's at, it's by far the brightest source in the sky. The Doppler velocities of the line range over at least 200 kilometers per second, and the line width is typically about 1 kilometer per second. So we're talking. That's the measured line width. So I'll get to the thermal. Well,
in other words, that Doppler line width that you're quoting is what the radio telescope.
Yeah, that's what the radio telescope can see, and probably by no coincidence, that of course is the Doppler line width at 300 Kelvin as well, right? So it's typical sound velocity. So there's a relationship there. This is happens one spectrum of our favorite source W49, and I suppose we divide the masers into inside and outside. And inside is essentially masers that shine at the Doppler velocity over the range of Doppler velocities of the host molecular cloud, and the outside are those outside that range. So it's of course there are probably some there is a distinction. As you can see, the inside masers tend to be brighter for one thing. Outside masers are these ones that go to very high Doppler shift. But, so then of course the problem once you've obtained all these data is the question of what do the spectra mean? In other words, you have these great spectra which vary a lot. They show all the structure. What does it mean? And you can in principle we make the claim, Tarja and I make the claim, that you can invert observations of variability and strength and so forth to find the parameters of the amazing gas. I suppose, for example, there's the space or shock velocity. And these are medians, so these are medians over large distributions of features. This is a paper that should appear today. To get back to this question of aspect ratio, there are two aspect ratios quoted here, one for a cylindrical maser and one for a planar maser. You can see that the planar maser has to have a greater aspect ratio. Basically, that's because in order to achieve a greater flux density, you need a narrower plane than you do a line, because the line, of course, produces a cone, and the plane produces a you're looking down a sheet for the plane. And you can come up with even more relaxed aspect ratios by postulating that what happens is that we happen to be looking at two clouds that are superposed along the line of sight that happen to overlap. And well, let's see. So that's sort of an advertisement for that work, which is certainly where my heart lies these days.
So we see an outside Mach number of 150 outside?
That is indeed my claim.
Yeah,
of course, those
outside the Maser,
essentially high Doppler shift compared with the range of.
That's a median.
That's right. Yeah, I'll show some other examples.
So
these are serious shocks.
They are due to the winds, not the jets.
This is from a model actually, and it has to do with I can't remember the details, but it. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. It's from a shock code that and well, I can. It's not far from this popular scaling relationship for the magnetic field strength with density.
That's 0.1 gauss. Is the magnetic field over here measured?
In
the OH masers, yes.
With the OH, you can actually do
Zeeman. There have been some claims of measurements of Zeeman splitting with H2O, but there are also, unfortunately, there's some radiative transfer effects
so
that can mimic that.
Come from the model.
These numbers come from the model, exactly. These are straight from the model.
Post-shock compression, is it limited by the magnetic field in the model?
Let's see. I believe so. You would know better.
Yes. It's a little odd that your median post-shock density is lower than your median pre-shock density.
Uh-oh, that is certainly a typo.
I thought it was just funny effect of medians.
That's possible. I have to. Yeah, that's a bit disturbing. I don't like that. I think that's a typo, though. I mean, it's possible from the standpoint of. I think, in fact, I suspect there's an error in the exponent in one of those numbers. Yeah, I think. Okay, in fact, I think this 6 should probably be an 8.
Yeah, plausible.
First typo discovered in the new paper. Hooray. Okay, so these strong H2O majors, they do lie in winds from evolved stars, but these lie in dense regions of molecular clouds, and they certainly lie in winds from forming stars. They're most prominent for high-mass stars, but they actually exist for both high and low-mass stars. And they often show both these high and low Doppler velocities, so inside and outside masers. The best explanation for these in molecular clouds seems to be that masers lie at the shocks where a strong stellar wind strikes some ambient material that's relatively stationary. That explanation goes back to about 73. And then the resulting speeds are low when the material is dense, high when the material is tenuous. And Mordecai Malklow and his collaborators are the first people to suggest that, which explains this high and low velocities. And they actually came up with a global model which for some of the outflow. This is what you would see if you looked at a maser with eyes that detected 22 gigahertz radiation, except it's not in color. This is quite old. It's from Craig Walker and collaborators. And basically what you see are just lots of little dots of different strength scattered over a region of sky that's a large fraction of a parsec across. And so this is small, very small in comparison with the molecular cloud. This is a tiny region that's very dense, close to the activity centers in the cloud. if you look at how these things are moving with time, you get something like this. These cones show the Maser motions, and so the ones with circles are Masers that are blue shifted coming toward us. The empty ones are ones that are going away. And what you see with your eye looking at this thing is that there's some cones that are big, some cones that are little, some that are very little. There are lots of dots in these sort of zones. The cones aren't all aligned in these zones, and there's sort of an overall outflow and some tendency of bipolarity with blue shifted here and red shifted over there. Here's the spectrum at that time. You can see that there's all this activity of the in the sort of quote inside range unquote, and then there are Maser spectral features that go way out on each side. So each of these peaks corresponds typically to just one dot in the picture above.
These are VLBI measurements.
These are VLBI measurements, yeah. So this is, I can tell you more about the VLBI experiment, but basically you just follow the dots with time. Yeah, it's quite a tedious, difficult experiment, but getting much easier now with the VLBA. This is a model for expansion velocity. I guess the intriguing thing about this to me is that the high velocities are on the outside, so the fastest motions are at the outside of the cluster. And any kind of sort of ordered explosion or expansion model that you can come up with that won't work. And this is where Mordecai's idea of sort of a pre-existing density structure makes it possible to explain these.
We actually ended up in MacLeod at all 94 saying, look, just a jet and a uniform medium.
Ah, okay, yes, right, sorry,
better,
yes. Sorry,
better explanation.
Yes, so there's some segregation of the momentum content of the jet. That's what I should have said. Okay, believe it or not, there's some rotation, too, of this thing. Go ahead.
Can you clarify this, please?
Oh, sorry.
What are we seeing now?
Okay. Well, actually, what you're seeing, there's, or go ahead. Or, this is a little more complicated. As you can see, you're measuring three components of velocity here now, and you're measuring two of position. And if you have a model, you can infer the sixth degree of freedom, which is position along the line of sight. The simplest way to do that is just to assume that all these things are coming from a common center, and so then So let's say the center is here, and so this blue shifted Maser, we have to put it at such a point that it points back to that center. That's the simplest model. One can come up with more sophisticated models, but so you restore that third degree of freedom, and then you can calculate compare the expansion velocity with distance from the expansion center. So this is a slightly more complicated model than what I just described, but same principle. Yeah, and there's also rotation as a function of position from the center. You get some typical net rotation velocity, which is actually about 20 kilometers per second, and roughly flat rotation curve. Well, you can actually see it on this plot, especially if you have a little bit of imagination. If you look at these Masers here, if you follow them back, they would point somewhere like that. And if you follow these back, they point somewhere back like that. So these point below that, and these point somewhat above the center of the cluster. And you can restore that motion by supposing that there's some rotation which adds a vector component upward here and downward here.
I thought moved them spatially.
Yes.
So that the velocities were radial.
That's almost right. We do that, but then we allow them to have rotation as well.
That's right. Okay.
So there's it's another parameter that,
okay,
that must be
said. What's the 3D spatial structure? Are they jet-like thing?
I used to have a movie that would. I still have it somewhere. This is actually the cluster seen from the side, so deep projected and rotated. You can see it's I would say fairly jet-like, with the high velocity guys are more or less segregated on the ends. There's a lot of low velocity stuff going on in here. Okay, so great fun. One can have tremendous amounts of, once you've actually processed the proper motions, you can't entertain yourself at great length with this. Here's some other Maser clusters. These are some of the other famous ones. W49 is certainly the one that has the most proper motions at the moment. This is Orion Kale at the time. And there are actually, soon there should be some much more and better proper motions for Orion Kale, which show that indeed it is coming out from a common center right around here, which is also the site of an SIO. Well, there's lots of interesting structure, W51. Okay, so let me summarize all this by saying that you see these large clusters of individual features. Typical size might be a 10 to the 4 AU. The individual sizes have features have sizes of about an AU. The line widths are really 1 kilometer per second, and the lifetimes are about a month. And there's these organized motions, expansion, rotation, and there's a spatial offset of red and blue. On the other hand, if you look at things much closer up, this is in milliarc seconds. You can remember that a milliarc second is 10 AU. So this is about 100 AU across. So this is a tiny little piece of that huge picture. And what you see are, frankly, it looks not too dissimilar from the big picture. There are all these little spots which are now starting to show some structure.
Where are we sitting in the big picture?
We are right about here in that big picture. Yeah, that cluster. So you look at that and you get this. I suppose the point of the picture is that there are all these little dots, but there's not really. And interestingly, there's an overall velocity gradient. The blue shifted masers tend to be at the bottom of the picture, the red shifted at the top. But there's a lot of complicated variation within those regions. For example, here, these four masers span a distance of about 35 to from minus 35 to about minus 15 at least. So about 20 kilometers per second. So something like 20 times the speed of sound in this region. And so, of course, one could ask, well, are these associated by chance? Is it just by chance that this one is at this distance from that one? One can do some detailed estimates of this using correlation functions, which I'll talk about in a minute. The chance probability of these four being that close together on the sky by chance is 1 in a trillion or so. It's very small. Essentially what I'm saying is that this region, as compared with the entire size of the Maser cluster, is extremely small. So these things are not there. You can even look on smaller scales. This shows what the individual Maser features look like. Essentially, they have these sort of irregular shapes, and they have some spectral structure for each within each shape. No, these are what a snapshot looks like at one time. And so one sees, say, that this spot is at this position on the sky. And then if you move in Doppler velocity, you move across the structure in sort of an irregular way. It's not unbelievable from the standpoint of thinking that these are shocks, I would claim. There's another way of looking at this is to say that the velocity difference across the Maser features is typically on the order of the speed of sound or maybe somewhat greater. So essentially, they're exploding at the speed of sound. These are not gravitationally confined.
High velocity seem to be at the end. So if I happen to think of them as projectiles, then I could have thought, okay, maybe the range of velocities that have been shot out and the high velocities happen to be at the end. Otherwise, I mean, it's a flow. What's accelerating it?
The point is, if you have a jet, if you have projectiles, okay, then you would have to accelerate them somehow. And that's very difficult.
Only initially, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But if you have a jet with a
then you have a narrow region. Take edge out with a cocoon. So it is expanding out sideways, but very slowly sideways. But the stuff that's near the center is in a cocoon and expanding out rather slowly sideways, whereas the stuff out at the ends, which is the only stuff at high radial distance from the center, is at the end of the jet, and that's the maximum velocity of the system. So the jet is running into an ambient medium. It picks that stuff up, compresses and accelerates it. The stuff that happens to be at the ends of the jet is at large distance radially, although it's concentrated. So that's where the upturn occurs. And everything else is in the cocoon, which is just sort of slowly expanding out there, just slowly and gently, and that's the stuff that's close to the center. So you see cocoon, 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 step up at the end.
Yeah, there's, well, let's see. I feel like I should have prepared better in talking about the global structure of this thing. Actually, these cones show how far the masers would go in 150 years. So if you project them back, this whole thing, if you, in fact, one of the great problems of the whole field is that these things, if you take these motions at face value, you say the thing must be less than 150 years old, and then if you assume that, there are far too many of them.
Far too many.
Masers in general.
No, but these things are 150 years.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
This is the brightest water maser in the galaxy. It's probably the fastest moving.
Yeah, it
and
is.
There's only one of them. So it's probably okay that this is the youngest stellar jet we can see. This is basically the birth cry of a stellar jet.
How do you follow individual spots? It's
the same spot. When you look 3 months later, why should it? Essentially, let's see. In fact, I have a. I wish I had more than one plot, but. I don't even have the one I. This will do. No, it makes just as much sense either way. Essentially, what happens if you look at this thing at two epochs, you'll see sort of this green banana-shaped one like that at one epoch, and then like this at another. And you may find occasionally that things where one spot seems to have jumped from one feature to another. And I think what's going on in that case is simply that if you look at this spectrum, well, of course, if the red spot gets a little dimmer here, and the green one gets a little brighter, then one sees a spot there rather than there. We don't have the dynamic range to see both of those spots at the same time. I can talk a little bit about the technical aspects, but basically what you see is that there's sort of this believable motion of at least some of these things. This one seems to have distorted a lot. Yeah, so you identify Doppler velocity and position, and then for this picture with the cones, we make sure that we can see them at least three epochs, and that they follow a straight line to a certain precision. That
does it have to be a straight line?
Yeah, straight constant velocity at straight. Yeah, so but the precision of that it's just a milliarcsecond or something. You know, it's sort of a So I wouldn't allow something that went like that and back there. But something that goes like, say, this and then there, that's okay. And in fact, okay, you can also look and see what about the ones that don't go in straight lines, which is another talk. I should have brought a lot more geographs. It turns out that if you look at... this is another great thing.
So don't worry about it.
Okay. So we identify ones at the three epochs that travel at constant velocity to within a certain precision. And then one can also come up with a statistic, which is say that the RMS residual as a function of time, in fact, I think I call that psi. And then if you plot n versus psi, there's a a very clear central distribution with the number of features that that have this particular
jitter.
Yeah, that's the correct term. So as so one can study the question of given a very broad acceptance for every imaginable thing that could be identified between epochs, what is the degree of jitter as a function of number? And what one sees is that we can measure the width of this. It may be set by propagation effects, at least in some cases. And then there's a very broad wings that go off essentially to infinity. One can also study questions of, like, what is the lifetime of a Maser feature? In other words, how does that jitter evolve as one extends the span of the observations? Okay, what I'd like to do now is really focus on turbulence. So we have these lists of spots, and one can ask the question, are these clustered? And so this is this shows the number of spots, or the density of features, at a difference, given difference in right ascension from a given feature. So given a feature, one of these Maser spots, what's the probability of finding another, say, 10 to the minus 2 arc seconds away? Or how many features are there per unit area at a distance of 10 to the minus 2 arc seconds away? And what one observes is that, well, there's a lot of sort of random variation, but there's this characteristic distance of, say, about 100 one hundredth of an arc second, where the features tend to start showing power law behavior, and then that power law behavior persists down to about the limiting accuracy of our measurement, which is about 10 to the minus fifth arc seconds, so 10 micro arc seconds.
That's like small fractions of an AU.
That's exactly right. About a tenth of an AU. Is that right? No, it's a hundredth of an AU.
1 arc
second
was 10 AU.
1 milliarc second was 10 AU. This is 1 AU, so this is about a tenth of an AU.
Okay,
and
so
and then
from
I...
From
100 AU to a tenth of an AU, there's power law behavior in this two-point correlation function. This is precisely the same two-point correlation function that James Peebles talks about in his book on cosmology, except this is one-dimensional, where he has a two-dimensional one. The reason why we use one-dimensional is that our astrometry is much more accurate along one direction than the other. So we prefer to use the accurate direction. So this basically says that those Maser spots cluster in a power law fashion over about three orders of magnitude in distance on the sky, for whatever that's worth. They tend to associate together.
It's a very flat power law.
Yes, flattish. I agree. It's let me show you some more. One of the questions is what is this telling us? Let me get back to that later. But I mean that is indeed.
Yeah.
I'm glad Mordecai is here to give the interpretation.
Well, you may disagree with it. Yeah,
I
think it's important for me at least to have a global sketch of what you think it is, so that I can actually put the frame.
Okay. Well, I think what everyone would agree on, I hope, is that. The essential parts of the picture are that you have a star. It has a wind, strong wind coming off of it. And then that wind is striking ambient material. And where the collision occurs is a shock. And possibly some other selection effects are operating.
The termination shock.
Or maybe there's more than one. It's possible that there's shocks in the wind, where the wind is sped up and slowed down, these catch-up effects, things like that. There are also certainly selection effects. We need velocity coherence along the line of sight, so maybe shock orientation is important. But essentially, we're talking when I say maser, you should think shock. It's just as when I say AGN, you should think black hole. Yes, that's right. It's a column density. No, exactly. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. Yeah, and I can say a little bit about what that column what the physical distance could be. One can say something about that from the constraints on beaming angle. So typically, we're talking the distance across one of these shocks is given by the width of that plateau, which is about an AU, and the length of these things. For these brightest masers, could be 100 AU. So we're talking, it could be just, so one possibility is that in this extremely turbulent region, we have a 100 AU long column of mazing gas, which by chance is holding together. I think a much more plausible explanation really is that you have two clouds that might be as much as 101 to 100 AU apart. So essentially, nothing matters about this cylinder except the end caps.
So you have a given velocity, and then you go out along the line of sight, and you have sure with the same velocity, or within a narrow interval of the same velocity, then they can interact.
Yes, exactly. And they can produce this this cone of radiation that the observer sees. And of course, the further away these two things are, the narrower the cone.
So it's funny, because it's like a funny combination of spatial and velocity coherence. When you look at the plane of the sky, you see spatial clustering, but along the line of sight, you see something about its velocity.
Yeah, well, let's see. I don't think the proper motion. Let's forget the proper motions for now. They're interesting. They just to tell you something about this. No. These are all. Everything I'm talking about now is Doppler. Okay. Yes.
Oh, okay. So you're just picking points along your spectrum.
Yeah. This is just one spectrum. Okay. So there's the question of how much are we involving velocity coherence along the line of sight in what we're observing? It's a selection effect. We have lots of selection effects.
When you have a cluster of major spots, would you associate them with many shocks or essentially one large shock?
What I imagine is one very large shock which is extremely corrugated.
For instance,
you might prefer more shocks. It's tough. I think I guess the short answer is it's difficult for.
We do know that there's a central star there, and we know there's a ring of O stars in the neighborhood. So it's a very massive star.
Maybe I should. Yeah. I feel like I kind of cut the material on the environment to a minimum, and here you all are asking about it. Yes. Okay. I mean, if you look at this plot, if you look at this picture, there's the question of how much can we learn about this region from other wavelengths? If you look at radio continuum maps, there is some structure here. And as one goes to higher and higher frequencies, it becomes more associated, more correlated with the maser. And the frequencies are high, and the resolution is quite poor. We aren't talking about anywhere near the sub-milliarc second sizes of the masers, but you see some structure here that's reminiscent of that. At even lower resolution, although it's improving rapidly, if you look in the far infrared, this is a very bright far infrared source right in here. And it is, if you look on larger scales, there's a molecular cloud that cloud is one in a ring of molecular clouds. And those molecular clouds have a lot of active high mass star formation going on in them. So it's.
The reason for my question is, I'm just trying to get some picture. Let's say I have one shock, and the flow is sort of smooth around it, mm-hmm. on a scale that covers many major spots. But of course, there's a velocity gradient.
Mm-hmm.
And each major spot could be associated only with a limited region of the foreshock flow, meaning the velocity difference across the major shouldn't be too much.
Mm-hmm.
So the major densers might be more limited regions in a much larger, smoother flow. It's not as if it's cut up into many pieces.
I like the model, but let me show a little more data, and I claim that more data will eliminate that model. If you look at the number of spots that have a given difference in Doppler velocity as a function of separation, so if you look at relatively large separations of, say, separations of 300 to 3,000 microarc seconds, I guess you should think a microarc second is, it's small. It's a hundredth of an AU. So this is 3 to 30 AU. Over that sort of separation, well, the velocities tend to be the same. And quite commonly, the velocity difference over that region is subthermal. But really, there are quite a few pairs that have velocities that differ by, say, 10 kilometers per second, many times the thermal velocity.
Do you think that this is evidence for pre-existing very tiny density structures?
I mean, some of them are just like
pre-existing. Well, this
would be a regional cloud. Can I draw a picture? Yeah, go ahead,
Mordecai.
It's really an unnecessary hypothesis. I mean, if you look at a jet, okay, with a termination shock, what you get out here is quite a complex cocoon structure. And this is well known from jet simulations. Okay, so you've got these rather strong shocks here that are running into a very complicated self-made structure from the cocoon. Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities.
So, okay, but the Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities grow increasing with wavelengths until something turns it over. So, what gives you the scale of maximum growth?
The beam size. I mean, you have a certain.
Okay,
thing,
so
yeah.
But if you had a pre existing clumpy structure, so, I mean.
Well, here's
the there anyways.
Must be in this external shock because. Because the otherwise they'd be completely dead, or in some intermediate set of shocks in here. If you look at jet simulations, you do have a lot of shock structure in here that's ready to produce masers, and the slow stuff would be in the expanding shell out here.
Yeah. Well, I think let's see. I guess my as the speaker, I will comment on this picture. Generically, I think this that okay. I would okay. Generically, this is one possible idea. You don't. I mean, I just
you don't know what's in there.
Yeah. For my purposes, it's irrelevant. So, and in this picture, there's a fluid instability which produces a lot of fine scale structure, which produces both the Maser action and the power law correlation function, et cetera. So that's one picture. I suppose another picture is the one that I don't remember who was mentioning, where you have a wind with uniform momentum density impacting stuff that has extremely small scale density structures of less than an AU, which is a little hard to swallow that you'd have these pre-existing density structures. Oh, I see.
That's a different
medium. I know, but we
understand the medium. Okay, well, there's that. I mean, Meyer's observation and that whole set of observations is certainly.
Yeah. What kind of star is the one that is?
It's O star.
It's an O star.
Yeah.
Is there an ultra-contact region or an region?
If you look at short radio wavelengths, you see ultra-compact.
Because in that case, probably the fourth ionized region is larger than whatever wind
what region it is.
Mm-hmm.
And
trapped in the shell.
Right. But probably the wind is inside an expanding edge of the region. And probably what we're seeing is not a shell created by the wind, but a shell created. We're talking about 100 tons.
Yeah. Oh, it's too fast. I think the photoionization must still be trapped inside the
I think that I would tend to agree. Yeah. Otherwise,
But then, if you have a wind-driven shell which is photoionized, then it can break into a lot of
I know. But the point is, the densities here are tremendous. These are like densities of a million stuff. You haven't had a chance.
What we know is there are some blocks with these densities of the order of 10 to the 10, but we have no idea what the densities of the shell may be. They can be substantially lower, and for some reason we're picking up only the very high density.
It's just what there is a coherent shell with these high densities. This is very young dynamic. It'll get to the fragmentation, and then it'll get sort of these scattered measures.
Well, let me wrap up this. I think it's, I guess I'm mostly interested in kind of the microscopic or what I might call the intermediate scale structures between the sizes of these individual features and the large scale global morphology. The interesting thing, in my opinion, about this plot is that, you do see kind of correlations on the typical thermal line width, but you also see these extremely high wings which drop as you go to smaller separation. And this is similar to the phenomenon of intermittency in Kolmogorov turbulence, where as you there's strong correlations over a narrow range, and then as you go it's relatively uncommon to have large velocity differences over larger ranges. Another way of saying it is that the one number doesn't characterize this velocity distribution. They're two, and they both change as you travel outward. So I've made a crude attempt to describe this by means of a correlation function, two correlation functions actually. If you look at the RMS velocity difference as a function of difference in right ascension, so given two features that have a given velocity separation, what's the RMS difference in velocity? You see a power law behavior as well. The difference in velocity is like separation to the 0.23, about separation to the 1/4. Of course, it turns out that this number reflects those broad wings. So what we're measuring, what we're seeing here is that they're very broad wings. If you try and look at the median velocity difference, which is an attempt to get closer to that more centrally condensed distribution, what you see is the median also shows power law behavior, which is proportional to the separation of the 1/3. And to sort of return to these issues about the alphane velocity, the difference in Doppler velocities across these regions, which are, say, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 1 arc seconds, are about 100 kilometers per second RMS, or maybe 50 median for the distribution, and then they drop down to about the alphane velocity for the median, and maybe the to something like 8 times the sound speed at this characteristic scale of a few tens of microarc seconds. So
that scale is bigger or smaller than the Mazur.
That is the Mazur spot. That is the Mazur spot size. So at a Mazur spot size, the median difference in velocity drops to subsonic or about sonic. So again, I would just say the Mazur spots approximately have sonic velocity gradients across them in Doppler velocity. They're exploding at the speed of sound. So this is scaling of the power law with separation over 2.5 decades. And this sort of power law scaling is evidence for fluid turbulence, or is often said to be evidence for fluid turbulence. I'm not sure if you think it is in this case. But let me just really emphasize that that these Maser spots, which are showing velocity differences of, you know, tens or 100 kilometer per second at separations of say between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 1 AU, those are physically associated. These are not just spots that happen to be together on the sky, and that's demonstrated by this sudden surge in the correlation function at about that scale. So we're seeing velocity, we're seeing Masers that have velocity differences of 100 kilometers per second, and yet they are associated, so a few hundred times sound speed. I can also talk a little bit about these low and high velocity Masers. You can form separate correlation functions for the autocorrelation function for low velocity features, autocorrelation function for high velocity. So these are separate correlation functions for low and high Doppler velocity ranges. And you see this power law behavior. The interesting thing is that if you cross-correlate them, you observe that they're correlated on scales of about 100 AU, or maybe a couple hundred. But then within those scales, there's no association. So what does it all mean? This just summarizes it. Again, we have the same question that we did with the spectra originally. What does it mean? why a power law correlation? In principle, these regions should communicate at the sound or Ralph Vane speed. This should say a cascade cannot develop for hypersonic shocks. It says the opposite. The idea here is that if you have these hypersonic shocks, 110 or 100 times the Ralph Vane speed, then it's a little hard to believe that you have some instability that preserves the energy. A big eddy turns around, breaks up into two smaller ones, and this happens over three orders of magnitude in length scale, all without energy being lost and the cascade being destroyed, or maybe at least it occurs. If that happens, it occurs in a self-similar fashion. So it's a little hard to believe that this is a real turbulence cascade. On the other hand, so what are the explanations? One possibility is that there's some initial power law correlation that initial. You can put it in the initial conditions. You could say that there's instabilities either in the C shocks or cocoon, something like that. You could put it in the stellar wind. You could say that the stellar wind has some funny correlation function. Put it in the initial conditions of the stellar wind. Or you could say there's some unmodeled deterministic V, and if we just understood what was going on, that all this would go away. I tend not to believe that because these power law correlations are not really consistent with an overall gradient. So I hope I've left you with the impression that there's some data here, there's a mystery, need some ideas.
I agree with you that the cascade probably cannot develop, at least not a standard cascade.
However,
we do find power law distributions of various quantities in hypersonic turbulence. So it's
mm-hmm.
not clear that it's hopeless.
Let's see. Yeah, I'm very curious about those because what I'd like to understand is how you can get this sort of correlation, power law correlation function in the face of inability to communicate over long distances.
Well, but you can't communicate because you've got hypersonic motion, random hypersonic motion.
Yeah, so... there's in this picture there's some sort of a messenger that you
don't have just a single shock, you have a region.
Yes, exactly. You have lots and lots of shocks.
And it's a fairly small regions.
I suppose, right. That's an idea. I suppose I should also mention the work by Strelnitsky at this point. Strelnitsky's intrigued with this idea. He's, of course, the guy who came up with the shock model. So what he's been doing is things like taking a volume and filling it with turbulence with a known power law description, and then supersonic.
He has shocks in
it? No shocks, but supersonic velocity field that has a power law behavior. I think that's right, or maybe. Okay. Yes. Great. Is this? Yeah. Okay. Well, this is yours, not Strelnitsky's. So yeah, he would like to duplicate these statistics. He claims that the filling factor of the shocks has to be extremely small.
These regions at a temperature of about 300 kelvins.
Yeah. Well, it's more that if you get much colder than that, or much hotter, the amazing
so
laser
would
effect is
quite. I'm just trying to get some picture. So there's a flow. Maybe there's a shock at one end, the missing regions identify. I mean, the masers identify regions whose temperatures are which are temperature spots of 300 kelvins in the shock or any. Yeah, in the post-shocked region.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But I thought that it was a way, a campaign there was this instability which was rising at the boundary of the cavity where the matter.
Well, the overall flow must have this shock because you see this big ordered motion, right?
No, but there is some. The wind is driving gas which is creating a cavity.
It's probably at the outer shock of the cavity, right? The cavity is expanded, So there's an outer shock there. The shaping of that outer shock is from Pelvin Helmholtz's abilities inside. You know, like the Norman Smart jet simulations, any other? Yeah,
well,
so it'll create lots of structure, but you still have shock.
To understand the structure? Well, let's see. I suppose, I guess put it this way, what kind of questions would you like answered? Pardon? Well, there are other masers. And I guess in fact.
The problem is being structures inside a fraction of an arc.
Oh yes, you see the LBI.
Right,
with
the LBI, you can see molecules. No. Yes, exactly.
There are lots of. Other H2O masers, which are written very light pencil on this plot. Like this one is 440 gigahertz. And, you can learn some interesting things from this. I suppose there are masers that are pumped only by C shocks, and there are masers that are pumped only by J shocks. And interestingly enough, you see that indeed the masers that are pumped only by C shocks are found only in the the velocity range of the inside masers. My collaborator's supposedly writing that up, and my other collaborator keeps me from beating him up for not getting out fast enough. Let's see. There are Zeeman splitting detections, in fact, in this source, which claim field strengths of 50 milligauss.
Do you know where the OH masers might be located?
The OH masers, okay, well, this is another plot. There are OH masers all over this region, but right at the location of the H2O masers is an extremely wide spectrum of of OH. Actually, what I here's the advertisement that I should give, and I wish I'd brought this plot, for Orion. In Orion, of course, Orion is only 500 parsecs instead of 10 kiloparsecs, and so the sizes are much more accessible. And Lincoln Greenhill is doing a big project on H2O masers in Orion. There are also other species of masers, SIO masers, and of course one has tremendous amounts of molecular data from these regions, and as well as infrared. And I can try to give a description of. Here's my version of the description of what he's seeing. I suppose I was on one of these papers. There's sort of a. The SIO masers are sort of on the sides of a cone.
What scale is that?
This is 50 AU.
Cool.
And then there's a so-called shell. There's a picture of this on my webpage, actually. I'm very proud of it. There are H2O masers on the outside of this shell. And he's measuring the proper motion of both. And then these well-known structures seen in SIO in Orion to very large scales kind of come out like this.
Where's
BN and KL?
This
is KL.
This is focusing on KL.
Yeah, this is KL. I'm not sure where BN is. It's kind of off somewhere.
But on the scale that you drew the SIO, is BN in the picture?
No.
Is it still? What's the other scale?
I would say, don't believe anything that I say about anything beyond 1,000 AU. There's been some interesting reports of a reflection nebula seen in the at 10 microns up here from the Keck people. And of course the goal would be to do polarization on it. So it's essentially it's the same picture. You know, again, you have in fact it looks a lot more like what Mordecai was talking about than I was thinking of. You have these, you know, you have sort of a presumably I think it's I would certainly bet a lot that what's dominating these regions is outflow. There's certainly in the velocity distribution on the sky, there's absolutely no evidence for rotation. There is evidence for outflow on the sky. So there's outflow. The structure of the outflow is rather complicated. There are shocks, there are masers, there's turbulence, presumably.
So what is the jet as well?
I think... Our thinking at the moment is that there's very high speed gas coming out at the bottom and the top.
So what goes off in the equatorial direction?
Much lower speed outflow.
So you're thinking now this is sort of the circular wind.
The circular wind, I don't know that phrase.
The spherical wind.
It outflows in all directions as nearly we can see. It's the dynamics are dominated by outflow from zero to thousands of AU.
What's the velocity
of
that shell?
It's not tremendous. It's 20 kilometers per second or something like that, so it's quite acceptable. So, anyway,
Is the shocks actually within the cone? You have a structure outside the cone. Is there actually anything in the cone?
We haven't seen anything in the cone at all, so it's empty. But presumably it contains a very high momentum density, very high velocity molecular.
What are the temperatures in the cone relative to the burial?
Okay, temperatures in the cone. Relative to burial temperatures. We can't really measure the temperatures in the cone, but the velocities in the cone are comparable to the burial velocities at less than 1 AU. So. Velocities are much, outflow velocities are many times real.
Sure, yeah, but the temperatures are less. I mean, they are real.
You're many AU away from the central source, and the burial temperature at 1 AU is equal to the temperature.
Yeah, and then probably
so your sub-burial is actually... no, your temperature is super-local burial.
Yeah. Well...
Yeah.
Well, I guess, let's see, what should I... Yeah.
But there was a